Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Carrie murdered a child.
The evidence and the counter-evidence, I'm struggling with that.
When the facts are filled with coincidences, don't dismiss those coincidences.
I have no tolerance for the unexplainable.
Well then, sir, you'll have no tolerance for me.
Hello and welcome to the final episode of Still Watching The Outsider. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
Each week on this podcast, we've been discussing the latest episode of The Outsider. This week, we will be discussing the finale, which is episode 10, Must Can't, written by Richard Price, directed by Andrew Bernstein. This appears to be a series finale, you would think, but we will discuss whether or not how hard they left the door open for a possible season two of The Outsider. We will get to that. We are also going to do something a little unusual in this episode. Usually we just stick to whatever show brought us here, but at the end of this episode, Richard and I are going to do a little Westworld preview. We're going to just talk about some things we're excited to discuss and looking forward to in season three, which will be the next show we'll be covering for Still Watching starting this Sunday. So, you know, you won't even have to wait a full week before you hear us again. Lucky you. Richard, before I get into even like emails from listeners, can you give me your overall temperature on this finale and, how it's sitting with you?
I'm suing HBO on Andy's behalf.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Let's get into that really quickly. Richard and I, we love our listeners. I swear to goodness we do, but please don't assume that we've seen an episode of a TV show, right as it's airing, because sometimes we haven't. And you find folks tweeted at both Richard and me last night, developments that happened in the episode before we had a chance to see them with our own eyeballs. And that's, you know, we would prefer that not happen in the future.
Yeah. I was on a Metro North train coming back into the city from Connecticut and just looking on Twitter and then was like, oh, God damn it. Yeah. So if best avoided, if possible.
Yeah. It's one thing for it to be in the feed that's sort of like, you know, look at Twitter at your own peril. It's when you at us, like, you know, then it just goes into our mentions and that's just a little bit more. So, good rule of thumb is this. Oftentimes networks do not send us screeners for finale episodes. So if it's a finale episode of a season and you're watching it live, don't add us because odds are, you know, I'm on the West Coast. I was moving someone this weekend. I did not have time to watch the episode right when it aired. So, we learned about Andy's fate via Twitter at replies. That's how we got that information. But you know, nonetheless, RIP Andy, RIP a lot of people, in this episode, actually.
Yeah.
The body count was pretty high. I guess I'll hit a few emails before we get into our discussion. So this first one is from, Jeremy Jurgens, listener. What an incredible name, Jeremy. I love this name. And this is all about Andy. And, Jeremy makes some interesting connections between how Andy is used in the TV series and how a different character is used in Stephen King's books. Because as we've discussed before, Andy is a show creation, RIP, and, is not from the novels. So Jeremy writes, love the pod, longtime listener, looking forward to going back to Westworld with you soon. I had a few thoughts about the Outsider finale as a book reader and King fanatic. And then he says, spoilers for the finale, but we assume since you've gotten this far, you guys are ready for spoilers. I know everyone is going to be terribly sad about our sweet boy Andy, RIP to a real one, and I am too. I did kind of see it coming from a mile away, but I was hoping that I would be wrong and he and Holly would move to the Oregon coast and open a bakery in a little town and both wear amazing knit sweaters and grow weed in their garden, but alas. Anyway, even though he's not in the book, Andy has doomed Stephen King love interest tattooed all over him. King often kills off girlfriends, boyfriends, partners, or spouses of his lead characters, often in surprising or dramatic way, but with his trademark and, dare I say, charming, on-the-nose foreshadowing, of course. In fact, Andy's death isn't too dissimilar to the death of a character in the book Mr. Mercedes, a woman who is actually Bill Hodges' love interest. That character is also killed in a car explosion by the villain of that story. What I thought was most interesting about Andy, though, is how he served as a kind of replacement in the series for Holly's backstory with Bill Hodges himself. While Bill and Holly never had a romantic or sexual relationship, their dynamic is quite similar to Andy and Holly, more paternal, obviously. Holly, who has never had any close friends or anyone to trust or confide in, finds in Bill a much-needed platonic intimacy, and his respect for her intellect and his humane treatment of her helps her find her inherent confidence and the strength to face real evil. In Richard Price's The Outsider, Holly still gets that arc, but it happens concurrently with her hunt for El Cuco, not before it. This time, the relationship is a more charged, physical, and sweet dynamic, but it still provides Holly with a confident co-conspirator and friend. So while I'm sad that Andy hasn't exploded, I'm also pretty tickled to see how Price and his collaborators on the series still managed to bring Holly Gibney's whole multi-book arc, or at least the broad swaths of it, to just one story. It would have been burdensome on this series to try and bring in or explain the Bill Hodges stuff, but they still managed to give us a solid version of her larger story. It's kind of like how the MCU finally gave their Peter Parker his Uncle Ben moment in Endgame, only his Uncle Ben in that story is Tony Stark. Anyway, that's all I got. Love this adaptation. Love King's book. Love Erivo in the part. Love the finale. RIP Andy. So that's from Jeremy. And I think that is a really interesting thing that I hadn't thought about. I mean, having not read the Mr. Mercedes stuff from Stephen King, I only have our listener emails about Bill Hodges and how his death in that book informs how Holly starts, in the Outsider book. And, I agree. That's not something that had occurred to me. It's very smart to still give her that arc, but not make a viewer have to know something about another book that they haven't read. You know what I mean, Richard?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think there, you know, we've complained about it a little bit that maybe this season should have been 8 episodes or whatever, but with a little bit extra length, you get to kind of include character stuff like that without making it seem, you know, kind of squeezing it in too forcibly.
And then ultimately, you know, we've been like worried since we met him. And so my question to you, Richard, is like, are we just too... Sometimes I watch TV shows with people who don't watch a lot of TV, and I get jealous of how like excited or shocked or whatever they get by things that you and I, who watch way too much TV, are just sort of like, well, obviously that's where it's going. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so my question about something like Andy, where like I felt like the foreshadowing Andy was so strong that then I was expecting a subversion of that foreshadowing, you know what I mean? I was like, oh, it's too obvious. But like, is that just because we watch too much TV, or did The Outsider, like, did that Andy death land for you the way that the writers obviously wanted it to in the end?
I mean, kind of yes and no. like, I get why it happened. And I, you know, like, it did seem obvious that it was going to happen. I think the big question was, which is what we were talking about last week, was just how dark is this show kind of trying to be? You know, like, what kind of point are they trying to make and how are they trying to make it? And I mean, they made it last night. Like, I feel, you know, like, it was a bit grimmer than I thought it was going to be. Yeah, I mean, I think with the particular case of Andy, not to say nothing of the other people who died in the episode, was it cruel to Holly in a way? Yes, but also, like you said, like in terms of the maybe vaguely open-ended season two possibilities, I don't think you want a character like that yoked to another, you know, yoked to someone. Like, I think you want them to be kind of independent on the wind, you know. And so, unfortunately, for potential future narrative convenience, Andy had to be dispatched.
Right. If they want Holly to be in another season, she can't have her happily ever after now, sort of thing. So much for the Portland dream of Jeremy's. Let's just talk about a few other deaths before we get into this other email that I want to read, which is, let's start with Seal Bolton. Seal Bolton, Claude's brother, you know, just gets a shotgun blast of the, or whatever that gun is. I don't know guns. Gets shot in the chest. This felt to me like, what was the point of this character? And like, what was the character motivation for him to charge forward like that? And did it have enough of an impact on Claude that it really mattered that Seal, you know, that his brother did that, in the end? Do you have any Seal thoughts?
I mean, he was a little kind of like the Nikki and Paolo of this show, right? Like, introduced and then killed, and you're like, huh? Why did we even bother with that? I didn't have any affection for that character. I didn't have any disdain for that character, because I didn't really, you know, that character just sort of existed and then didn't. And I guess it was trying to, like, prove a point about the sort of grief ripples, you know, because now, because now Claude will have to deal with that. Like, so even though they defeated the outsider, his effect still lingers quite heavily in the lives of the people, who defeated him.
Right. And so, Howie dies as well.
Which I was really surprised by that. That felt the most gratuitous.
Yeah. That felt like a lot. Like, basically, I think we both were like, oh, Eunice is definitely going to die. And he's the only one who lived. So, but I think all these people need to die, so that when Holly and Ralph both walk out of that cave, we're not like, what a, you know, how weak of them to not actually have stakes in this thing. So we're trying to give stakes by having this like bloodbath. But it's interesting. I was listening to the, I was watching the after episode, you know, they've been doing this like these post episode interviews with like Dennis Lehane, Richard Price, Stephen King, and the cast after like every three episodes or so on HBO. Like Game of Thrones used to do it after every episode, but this, they did it like every three episodes. And so they were, the director of this episode, Andrew Bernstein, was talking about how they have this like 12-minute shootout that opens the episode. And like, to me, it felt like when the Game of Thrones producers like would brag about a battle episode, and I'm like, ooh, that's just not why I'm here. Like, it's not why I'm here at all. And so like, it's interesting to me, this like, this turn we were expecting for Jack, did come eventually, and it came via Holly, right? Like her saying, damn you to hell, which felt like it had like supernatural weight and power as she shouted it at him. Mm-hmm. And then him being unwilling to shoot her because he does like her. And he's struggling throughout the whole shootout, right? Like he's drunk. His the casting of this actor is tremendous because his features just looked like so brutish in that sequence, just like, you know, heavy with alcohol and like having given up and all this sort of stuff. You know, but he would say things like when Andy would run out and get in the car, he's like, oh, why'd you have to do that? Like, I don't want him to kill you, you poor little puppy dog, but like you got in the car, so now I have to, sort of thing. But it, you know, and then he does the same thing that the last thrall did when he like, incited the cops to shoot him, where he was just like inciting the snake to bite him, so that he could be stopped, eventually. But like, I don't know, that like, once again, that turn didn't come in a way that made me feel like I understood exactly the arc of that character. I don't know if I'm missing something, or what, but how did you feel about the way that Jack ended here?
I mean, his kind of thing added to the whole general air of anticlimax to this part of the episode where mm-hmm. it was like, okay, so that just went like that and now it's done, you know? And I think I had, because we spent so much time with Jack leading up to this episode, I expected there to be more of a turn or something, you know, and him kind of falling on his gun at the end also seemed to kind of violate the rules of the thralls maybe not being able to kill themselves, although I guess those rules were never really laid out. You know, I didn't feel mad at it. I just was like, oh, okay. That said, I do think the show got to a sort of more, a richer place by the end of the episode. I didn't dislike the episode, but yeah, I think this, the shootout thing, it was just like, like you said, like, it's not why I'm watching the show. And it just, you know, it was well staged, I guess, but I just didn't really like care about it.
Right. I just didn't need a battle sequence like in The Outsider. Okay. So we've got this shootout. Almost everyone dies. Holly and Ralph go into the cave and Claude follows them soon after. One thing actually I really did love during the shootout though is like while the bullets are flying and the bodies are falling, we see El Cuco in the cave sort of like holding his hands up like he is. To me, I interpreted that as like feeding off the grief that was going on outside the cave, you know, that all of that, you know, it was sort of like a hands up in a sort of Pentecostal praise position, but it felt like I'm absorbing the like massive grief that I can suck off of like Holly and, you know, everyone else who's out there. And then we get this showdown, which once this also felt kind of anticlimactic to me. I agree with you. I like what happens after this, after the shootout and after the cave. I like the stuff that the wrap up, but this, I was like, okay, so, you know, they walk in. El Cuco, like, says, like, be careful, you know, don't slip. There's gonna be, you know, a cave-in, sort of thing. They confront him. Then Claude comes in and we've got the two Claudes, but there's never, like, a question of confusion over which is something you can play with when you have doppelgangers, but they don't. And then Claude fires his gun anyway, and, you could interpret it as everyone gets a chance to kill El Cuco in some way, right? So Claude shoots him, Holly stabs him, and then Ralph sort of bashes his head in. So what do you make? One thing that I thought was interesting that Richard Price said, let me find the quote, that he said in the post-episode interview. He's like, unlike most Stephen King monsters, we've talked about this, like, the kids in It confronting Pennywise in the sewers is very similar to, like, our heroes here confronting this monster in the caves. But he said something like, unlike most of Stephen King's creatures, this monster doesn't become, like, he says it's conversational versus phantasmagorical. And it doesn't become, in the books, my understanding is El Cuco like turns into these like red worms that can like latch onto you. And that's the thing that I did not want to see. And I like that they didn't go there. So anyway, what did you think of all the cave stuff that we got here?
Well, on the one hand, I feel that sense of the anticlimax, but also I kind of, in a weird way, like in the long view of the actual, of the whole episode, I appreciate that anticlimax because I think, you know, whatever this show was saying about how to conquer grief and, or at least live with grief and live with this kind of low level or higher than that fear about the dangers in the world while also trying to, you know, enjoy life in the world. I think it kind of meant something that, in the end, it was this entirely corporeal, killable thing, and it kind of happened quickly, and the thing sort of, you know, I think it seemed a bit reluctant about its own existence, you know, it was a kind of like a melancholy vampire, you know, Brad Pitt in an Interview with a Vampire or something.
Right.
And I think that like that, there was a point there that was just like, yeah, once you get to the heart of darkness, the thing at the center is just kind of like, you know, you or life. You know, it's not, there's not some, towering sort of entity that you, you know, that, that sort of is pulling all the strings. It's just like another thing, you know? And, I think that was sort of the point of it. And certainly like what, you know, ensued in the rest of the episode, I think kind of, spoke in that same, timbre. So yeah, like from like a just purely visceral, just like, you know, TV watcher, I was a little like, oh, huh. But then the more I thought about it, the more I kind of understood why it had to be a bit of a, anticlimax, because that's kind of been the point, I think, the whole time.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I really like what you have to say about him being like a lonely vampire. I think it's Richard Price or possibly Dennis Lehane said something that I jotted down and I thought was interesting, that yeah, like that this monster has been in isolation his whole life and this is finally a chance to explain himself. Like in Holly, in someone who believes in him without like being under his thrall, he meets something that he's never encountered in his existence. And she finds out how little he knows about himself. Like, he doesn't necessarily know that it, whether or not there are other things like him. He doesn't know, you know, like all this sort of stuff. And so there's something kind of pathetic and sad about him. You know, despite all the destruction that we've seen. I felt like when she asks why children and he says they taste the sweetest, I think you can't have that line in a post Snowpiercer world, where Chris Evans tearfully says babies taste the best. But nonetheless, they went for it. Most importantly, I think to this podcast, we finally know why, Jack was buying all those lamps. It's so this scene could have some lighting in it. I guess, right?
I guess so.
There were lamps in the cave and I was like, oh, is that why we had lamps earlier? Okay.
Where the electricity was coming from? Who knows? Did he also buy an extension cord?
The world's longest extension cord that like exits through the gift shop. Yeah, it's funny because, you know, a point that, Jason Bateman was making in the post episode interview. And remember that Bateman was like a producer and a director on the show, as much as he was a guest star in the first couple episodes, was that in casting the character of Claude, they wanted to find in Patty Considine someone who could really believably play, this sort of down and out petty criminal. And this like larger than life menacing monster. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny because I do think Patty did a really good job with that in the end. I think we've had some quibbles mm-hmm. about his accent, but like he's a performer we respect. And I think that there's like a shot reverse shot of the two of them. And all that's different is the facial expression. And I really did feel like I was looking at two different characters. But funnily enough, like as much as I love Ben Mendelsohn in the lead role in this show, like that is also something that I think Ben Mendelsohn would have done extraordinarily well, is play that dual role.
Fully. Yeah.
Yeah. We've seen him play a lot of petty criminals. So, I don't know. I guess I just don't know that I feel like I really track everyone's arc here. So, okay. But it feels like you have a better grasp on it. So I'll say really quickly, another email we got was from Maureen, who's been emailing all season about sort of book differences. And a big difference that a lot of people remarked on is that in the, book, it's sort of Holly who deals the fatal blow to El Cuco rather than like Claude who shoots El Cuco. And a lot of people are like, why would you rob Holly of her kill? I think Holly gets a lot to do in this episode, the way in which she basically is the one who stops Jack, essentially. And, you know, she does get to, I think all three of them have their role in killing El Cuco here. So I'm not mad, that it's Claude who shot him rather than Holly, who like in the books hits him with like a sock full of something. But yeah, I'm just not sure that I really understand like Claude's movement and arc here or Ralph. So Ralph, basically they're walking out of the cave. They think they've done the job. And then Ralph sees his dead son. And I, I'm guessing the original victim that we, I couldn't tell who the other kid was.
For some reason, I thought that was, the victim's brother who shot Terry and who like, whose face was kind of haunting him in the earlier episodes, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right. Cause he shot him. So, okay. So, his son and then Frankie Peterson's brother. But, and that makes him go back into the cave and like bash El Cuco's head in. So what is your interpretation of what Ralph is going through there?
I don't really know. I mean, I think it was sort of like, you know, part of just this like grief thing and, I don't know, telling it, he could beat it and making, you know, wanting to sort of be definitive about something to have closure, I guess, was kind of what was happening. I don't know that we needed it, but, yeah, it felt a little, and it was like, was he really seeing them? And I guess, was it El Cuco kind of causing him to see it? I don't know. It felt a little muddled.
Yeah. I wasn't sure, like, if, seeing those projections there is what made him decide that El Cuco was still alive, or if it was some sort of important journey through belief that he had in that moment. But I can't say I have a firm grip on either of those things being true. And so to me, it just feels a little like confusing. And then he sort of goes back to give a like Princess Bride to the pain sort of speech to El Cuco before bashing his head in. So once again, I don't know, like the shootout stuff and the cave stuff, like, there's some good performance stuff in there, but it doesn't really hit with me. And if the show had ended there, I would have been like really dissatisfied with the finale, but then we get a lot of this like really meaty, wrap up stuff. So, let's talk about that.
I'm just going to say, I don't understand what story they cook up. I don't understand the intricacies of like how they lie to the police while also exonerating various people.
Well, they were like, Jack is working in concert with a, you know, someone that they suspect is actually the person who killed Frankie Peterson. And as a result, all these people died in the parking lot of a gift shop, which is, you know, where they were technically. I guess perhaps, I don't know what kind of corpse they left behind after they bashed in El Cuco's head or what. Mm-hmm. I'm also confused. Sorry. I mean, like, I know our job is to sort of provide answers, but I rewatched this episode a couple times and I'm still like pretty confused. Like, I'm confused when Holly said, "Who's Terry?" That confused me. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. like, was she just like too caught up in her grief about Andy or whatever? Like it was a confusing moment for me. I agree. I don't really fully understand or how it's connected to the thing that happened last week with them finding like another kid and, you know, the like DA being like, oh dang, you know, like it's, they didn't meaningfully connect those two things in any way, in a way that I was expecting them to. But I guess the point is they figured out a way to lie in concert that exonerated Terry in some way. So that's interesting.
And Claude. Yeah, because he was sort of suspected in that other in trying to
right.
So basically, everyone's right. been cleared. Yeah,
right. So, so what do you make of let's go with the Holly scene first, and then we'll get to Jeannie. So how did you feel about the Holly wrap up here?
I mean, the who's Terry thing was confusing. I wasn't sure if she was making like a dark joke about like how far they'd gotten from their original intent in the investigation or what, but like, or if it was implying that the El Cuco had somehow kind of gotten in her head. Like I wasn't really sure about that, but I liked, you know, I kind of liked the explication of why the thing is called The Outsider. I thought that was well done by Erivo. And, you know, I like that kind of like wistful, like, you know, I don't know if I'll see you again, but like maybe, you know, we had this experience together but now we kind of, you know, gotta kind of resume our regular lives. And, you know, the show, you know, leaves things pretty open for season two with Mendelsohn and Erivo if they wanted to do that, you know. I mean, I think it was interesting that, you know, Ralph asks her as she's leaving, like, what do you think else is out there? And she shrugs. But she gives him this kind of like weary smile as she does it, which I think is interesting. And I think that there it's, you know, the kind of thing of like, well, what else could hurt me? And it's like, who knows? You know, like we have no way of knowing. And that's kind of one of the difficult uncertainties of life, you know? And I thought that moment kind of punctuated that well.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that it kind of feels like every limited series nowadays wants to leave the door open for a second season. If, you know, if the ratings are gangbusters or something like that, they want to make that an option. And so the door is very much left open, not just with like that, maybe we could work together moment, but also the mid credits, which seem to imply that Holly could also be infected, ? And then also the song that plays on the radio as the episode finally closes is the song that Ralph was talking about when he's talking about when his mother died, and all that sort of stuff. So like, I don't know, just like, hey, more spooky stuff is out there. Maybe it's El Cuco related, maybe it's elsewise, but you know, Holly's fight isn't over, sort of thing. I think for me to put a button on the Holly of it all, Cynthia Erivo's performance and Ben Mendelsohn's performance are like the real like joys of this series for me. And this as a calling card for Cynthia Erivo, because like, did she get nominated for an Oscar this year? She did. Did a ton of people see Harriet? Not really. And have a ton of people seen her great work on Broadway? You know, plenty, but not, you know, as many as maybe would turn into a Sunday night show on HBO. So my hope is, you know, and let alone, see Widows, or Bad Times at the El Royale. So like, though Cynthia Erivo is someone that you and I have been aware of, like, I'm hoping that this is something that really pushes her through to broader audiences. Cause I think she's incredible. And this is a calling card for things that she can do. Really excites me. And then Ben Mendelsohn is just, you know, amazing and everything. So good job, Ben. What about the glory of it all?
I mean, the glory of it all and the final scene with Jeannie and Ralph, I think, kind of are work in concert as they, because especially the Jeannie and Ralph thing is an inversion of the Ralph asking Holly, like, what else is out there? Like, what other dark things are out there? Because Jeannie takes this new sort of supernatural knowledge and says, well, maybe that just means we'll see our son again, you know, like she sees the kind of hope in that. And I think that the glory scene is located in the middle of those two things, you know, like she basically asks Glory to like, understand that this thing did happen, but like, don't tell any, like both believe it and don't believe it, you know? And I think, you know, I'm glad that we did, you know, I think it was necessary to have one last moment with Glory. And I think it was, you know, I liked how kind of quiet it was, and I liked how much Mayor Whittingham got to do at the end of the show.
Yeah.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
At eBay, you'll always get that feel of real because your fashion purchase will be backed by authenticity guarantee. Whether it's a knit bag, a must-have watch, dreamy jewelry, or fire sneakers and fresh streetwear, every step will feel authentic, every flex will feel real. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal with eBay Authenticity Guarantee. Visit ebay.com for terms.
All right. You threatened me with a good time, by telling me on Twitter that you were going to talk about the film Rabbit Hole, which is also about, the death of a child and grief. So what was that a joke or did you actually want to talk about it?
Well, no, I mean, I think that one of the final scenes in Rabbit Hole, which is about a, you know, mother played by Nicole Kidman, in the movie version, Cynthia Nixon did it on Broadway. Her son is killed he's hit by a car. And she's sitting on a bench, with the teenage boy who was driving the car that, killed her son. And, they're talking about, kind of like multiverse theory a little bit. And that there are infinite versions of ourselves, in other dimensions, that we can't see. And Nicole Kidman's character says something like that. I like to think about that, like somewhere out there, I'm having a great time. Or a good time or something. And it's just a really beautiful little scene with her and Miles Teller. And I just think that it's like something about Jeannie and Ralph sitting on a bench, in the cemetery, looking at their son's grave, kind of talking about what they've just experienced and what they kind of hope to experience in the future, is like taking a kind of boggling precept, like, not just, you know, multiverse theory, not just, you know, supernatural entities, the afterlife, but a complex theory like, you know, death and grief and all that stuff, and to kind of find a hope in it, you know? I mean, I think that's kind of like where probably religion is ultimately sourced, you know? Like, okay, so, you know, Ralph and Jeannie, we know this thing exists, or we know this multiverse theory thing exists in Rabbit Hole. So, like, what good is there to see of this scary thing, you know? Like, and I think that's just kind of about how people heal themselves, and it's maybe sometimes blinkered, but like we just try to find the hope in things, the silver lining in things, you know, if we're kind of predisposed to do that. So I don't know. I just think that scene was really pretty, and with Jeannie and Ralph, and I like that idea, that she puts forward, that like, you know, yeah, maybe this dark thing has really for even darker implications, or maybe it means that other wild and supernatural and sort of fantastical things, like seeing someone that we lost in the afterlife, is possible.
Yeah. I really love that scene. I love her burning the chair. I think she was also an incredible, incredible part. Maybe the shootout in the cave, didn't land perfectly for me because it needed more Mare Winningham, though. Thank goodness Jeannie was out of harm's way. There was another moment that I was confused by actually in the episode, is like, so she's burning the chair. You get this great, like, chair on fire image. And then we see Ralph exit, the police station. I believe he's still in Tennessee when he does this. And you see a truck go by with two people with lit torches in the back of a truck. And I was like, are those people going to the cave? Is that why they have torches? Wouldn't you wait until you got to the cave before you light your torch? Like, why are two people holding fire in the back? I rewound it like several times to try to figure out why. And you know, it was a nice visual of like the burning chair and the torches in the back of the truck. But I was like, I feel like there's just connective tissue missing here throughout this episode, actually. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, I mean, I think we did it. I think we did The Outsider. I think we did it. I am really glad you picked it. This is your pick, Richard. And I was a little like skeptical actually when you picked it. But you were right, and I should listen to you more often. And, I'm really glad.
Well, we've never done a comedy before, so I wanted to try that out.
Something zippy, something lighthearted us. So, before we move on to our quick Westworld preview, what will you be doing to honor the life of Andy, today, Richard?
Well, I'm going to pour one out in the parking lot of Big Daddy's Hangry Barbecue, of course.
Great. I will be going to Highway Heaven to get some fried chicken, and we will celebrate.
Well, maybe he'll be there. Heaven.
Oh, Andy, frying chicken in heaven. All right. So now we're going to talk about Westworld. This is not, you know, Richard and I have seen some of the upcoming season. We're not going to spoil anything. This is a more of like, where are we? What are we looking forward to? What's happening? Why isn't Ben Barnes here? Sort of thing. If you did not watch Westworld with us last 2 years ago, God, time. We covered season two. You can go back and listening to the still watching, Westworld episodes, in season two, if you want to get yourself, to ramp yourself up. We got some great interviews on that season. We're going to have some great interviews on this upcoming season of Westworld as well. But Richard, what, What is most interesting to you, without spoiling anything, about a season three of Westworld?
I think it's interesting that we're going to see the world that built Westworld, you know, we're traveling outside of the park, in this season. And, you know, I think in that this show is already pretty hard sci-fi, but, I think it's going to become even more so because it then opens up to speculate about more things that, exist, in the future, be they kind of social, schema or like technology or, you know, geopolitics and, you know, so I think that's kind of interesting. I liked on the first two seasons where you'd get these little like glimpses and like intimations of what that world was like. So I hope that like in fully exploring it, the show kind of, widens its scope in an interesting way.
Yeah. The description that I've been using is sort of like, it's like in Jurassic Park when, you know, the dinosaurs escape the island and the, you know, wreak havoc on the mainland is sort of like what we're seeing. This is, of course, a reference to the, classic film Jurassic Park, The Lost World.
Where a T-Rex runs through San Diego.
Yep. Yep. T-Rex, yeah. Except it's Dolores in China. So, you know, we've got, from the trailer, we've got some future China, some future LA, is happening, and, also some future Bay Area, fun stuff. Something that, you know, just based on the trailer alone, I think is pretty cool is like, okay, so we're missing, a lot of the, like, you know, they shot, the West World of Westworld out in, I think it was Monument Park, right? You know, these huge sweeping vistas, and they didn't CGI them. They did that. And something that I really appreciate, that they've done for this season is like shooting in the future in a cityscape, is more easy on your budget probably than shooting out, in the Mesa somewhere. But they didn't skimp on locations, and they found a lot of really, really cool real world existent locations, around the world to film in. There's like, the Museum of Art and Sciences, and I think it's Barcelona, or maybe it's, anyway, it's in Spain, is this huge, beautiful, white, futuristic structure, that you'll see in all the trailers. And so they just found a lot of really cool locations, that exist in the world and sort of dress them up a little bit to make them part of this whole, like, Delos future society. And you're right, Richard, we've heard bits and pieces about this society, like sort of, in the first season, we found out that, like, almost all diseases had been cured. They hadn't stopped death yet, but they had cured a lot of other diseases. I found out bits and pieces of sort of what the real world, was like. And so now we'll spend a lot of time there. The big addition to the cast is Aaron Paul, who plays the character of Caleb. And, you know, this will be something of, you know, a joke I made elsewhere, is that, Dolores always needs a boyfriend, whether it's Jimmy Simpson or James Marsden, but both of those guys aren't in this season as far as we know. So along comes Aaron Paul. I'm not saying he plays her actual literal boyfriend, but it's like, you know, Dolores likes a male foil. And
yeah, they haven't defined the relationship. They haven't had the talk yet, but you know, they're seeing each other. They're hanging out.
Yeah. So Aaron Paul is here. Richard, you and I were talking a little informally last night about sort of Aaron Paul and what we've enjoyed from him in the past. Obviously a lot of people know him, from Jesse Pinkman on Breaking Bad. You also mentioned his work on Big Love. So what do you feel like Aaron Paul is really good at, that, you know, hopefully he will be able to tap into this season?
I mean, he's an actor who in most of what I've seen of him, is playing someone, who exists or is entering into a strange world, be it the world of polygamy in Big Love, where he played Amanda Seyfried's boyfriend or character's boyfriend and maybe then eventual husband, I forget. Or, you know, venturing into the world of, you know, drug cartels in Breaking Bad or cults in, what was that show
the
called?
The Path.
Yeah. You know, so I think that like he could be good at being this sort of like, our one of our conduits, you know, into this world that, but then again, we also have, Dolores navigating things. Presumably Maeve is going to get involved and, Bernard. Arnold, Bernard or slash Arnold, you know, so like, so maybe we don't necessarily need a new character to introduce us to, you know, the world outside Westworld, because people we already know are going to be doing that for us. But he's, you know, he is human and everyone else is a robot. So maybe that's a crucial distinction.
Right. Our human proxy.
At least we assume he's human.
Yeah. There's always questions about the nature of the reality, in Westworld. And then, I mean, I guess I'm excited to, you know, see what everyone thinks of this. This is, I agree with you. It's much more like Blade Runner than it is, you know, the Westworld that we've seen. It's a very different show. It's almost like a soft reboot, which is something we talked about at the end of season two. Like that, you know, they killed off a bunch of characters. It's pretty much only our hosts that are still, like, you know, going, and they're largely moving location, though we still have some people left in the park. And so, you know, if you're here for Evan Rachel Wood, you're here for the duration. So there you go. I guess I'm interested to see how some of these more, you know, social techno, you know, robots, they're just like us, in the real world, how that's going to land with audiences, and especially how, like, because this conceit as explained by this trailer that they released, where they talked about, these, various aberrations in history. I don't know if you saw this trailer, it was narrated by Vincent Cassel, but it was just sort of like, these things that happened, these riots, these, you know, whatever. And I'm like, we're in the middle of this possible pandemic, or at least we're treating it like a pandemic. We're fearful. Society feels like it's like breaking down a little bit. Maybe not New York. Richard, we were talking about this. New York maybe doesn't panic out so much, but California, our shelves are bare. It's very weird out here right now. And so, like, what an interesting time to watch this, like, futuristic, you know, what will become a society, you know, after a crisis sort of show. So, here's to watching Westworld in love in the time of cholera, Westworld in the time of corona. Here we go. Or maybe this will all be over by the time, the show actually premieres. I don't think so though. Anything else, Richard, that you want to talk about?
Yeah, they're going to solve it in 4 days. Yeah.
I believe in Mike Pence. It's going to be fine. What's up?
I'm excited. This is a fun show to talk about. It's a fun show to speculate about. You know, it's not based on a book. It's based on an old movie. Or was it a book first? No, I think it was just Michael Crichton made the movie. So it's not like The Outsider, where we had a, you know, if we wanted to peek, we had a roadmap for maybe where the thing was headed. In this case, we have no idea.
Though something I might suggest is, I know that some people went and watched Westworld, starring Yul Brynner, when the show first premiered. There is another film called Future World, which is a sequel to Westworld, that I've never seen. But this season seems to draw from some of the Future World stuff. So you might want to check that out if you want to do some extra homework. Really important though, Richard, without Ben Barnes and James Marsden, who are our Westworld boyfriends this season? I mean, I guess it could be Aaron Paul, but are there any other good options here? Big Daddy Vincent Cassel? Like, what are we going to do? What do you think?
No, I, well, for one thing, Rafi Gavron is briefly in the season, I believe, as a kind of like jerky rich guy. And he was in Rome and, A Star is Born, he played the bad manager who everyone hated.
I
thought he was cute ever since, for a while. Anyway, so he's in it. But, I really think, like, you know, regardless of gender and sexual preference and all those things, I mean, I'm just going to go to Maeve.
Tandy Newton.
She's right there. She's my partner for the season.
She's your constant. I love it. All right. So, I will latch on to the possibly evil, Vincent Cassel, who I have loved for a very long time, and you can have Maeve, and we will just divide and conquer that way. Our options are open though. So if you guys have better candidates for us, let us know. All right. Well, Richard, until we officially travel, to Westworld and Beyond, where can folks find you?
Oh, I'm just going to be like in the old bordello, just playing like ragtime covers of pop songs for the next week in honor of the first season of Westworld. Where will you be?
yeah. Cue up the old timey piano, Radiohead. I will be freeze framing every screen, tablet, cell phone shot in the episode. I got to tell you, for someone who like makes a habit of close watching Westworld, the fact that they've moved to a setting where there are a lot of screens with potential info on them has made my process of watching episodes much slower. So I will be obsessively poring over screenshots, hoping to have all the answers for you guys. More answers than I don't know why Holly said who's Terry. You know, when we come back for Westworld, you can find me on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. And you will hear us this Sunday, right after the episode of Westworld premieres. This, podcast, Still Watching Westworld, will drop in your feed and you will hear us talk all about the future of Dolores, etc. We'll see you then.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.